thank you. I apologize, but my daughter broke her knee and she needs somebody to haul her to school every day. So I have to do it. Tomorrow my wife is doing it today, so I have to go back. But it was for a good cause. She played soccer and she scored. Anyway, so today, I don't know if these things need to. They do. Okay. Today I want to tell you a little bit about a series of experiments that actually are the thesis work of Craig Harald, who is a graduate student of mine, who's finishing actually the end of this month, namely in a few days. And these are experiments on doing STM on BSCO single crystal. And I want to show you a variety of results. Especially, I will concentrate on results that may indicate some phase separation that appear on the surface of these materials. These experiments started, in fact, at the lab of Don Eigler, IBM Almaden, when actually I sent my student, Craig, to work with my former student, Ali Yazdani, who was finishing there to learn the trade. Then he came back and we built our own STM. Since there is interest in the second part of the talk, which is the more ordered part, that's the so-called stripes, I will try and fast forward the first part, which is the inhomogeneities part. Then if you'll have questions, I can come back to it. But anyway, the motivation, of course, is obvious. We can have high spatial and energy resolution using STM, and we are fortunate to have materials in this high TC family that cleave very well, that allow us to do good spectroscopy. That's the generic phase diagram. I don't want to talk about it. You probably hear lots of. Let's move to the other one. That's. I actually started to set up in the other room when. I just want to. You probably also heard know this phase diagram. I just want to mention that I'm going to concentrate on experiments, on samples that are in this vicinity. Some of these samples were made in my group, earlier samples by Patrick Fournier, and later Hiroshi Isaki came to Stanford and made probably what are now the best BSCO samples that one can get. The STM that we built has a base temperature of 6K, vacuum of better than 510 to the minus 10, that's basically UHV. And we've been using either gold or iridium tips. And another important thing is to remind those that don't do STM experiment is that when you do STM, you basically put a constant voltage across the sample, and you monitor the current. In the experiments I'm going to show, topography experiments, will have a set voltage of minus 200 millivolts, way above the superconducting gap in these materials, with a set current of 100 picoam. Why BSCO? BSCO cleaves very well in between the two bismuth oxygen layers. So this is certainly a great advantage. We can make very large crystals of this material, another advantage. These may not be the perfect crystals for neutron scattering measurements because they are usually platelet and large in the so-called AB plane, but not very thick. But for STM, they are perfect. And one can control doping in these materials in a variety of ways. The easiest one is simply to put oxygen in and take oxygen out. The disadvantages are that there is a superstructure along the B-axis and related the oxygen stoichiometry at the surface is basically a guess. Not exactly because we can monitor movement of oxygen. I'll come to this in a minute. This, I think, both the fact that where it cleaves, the superstructure and the oxygen stoichiometry, I think, are very important, especially when theorists get excited about results on BISCO. So if you do topography, that's what you get, and you see that there is this superstructure that's at 200 angstroms by 350 angstroms topograph. You can see individual atoms. You zoom in, and you see better that superstructure. So let me say a few things about it. This is basically work that we did back in 88 when we first found, using STM, previous generation STM, the superstructure and what it means. Bismuth oxygen bond in nature is very short. ITC are governed by the long and stiff copper oxygen bond. So when the bismuth oxygen layer is trying to cope with this long lattice constant, it stretches, and then after a few lattice constants relaxes by missing oxygen rows, okay? So the stoichiometry, the perfect stoichiometry of this BISCO is, you remember, 221208, but usually there are missing oxygens due to this superstructure. So there are two remarks. First, when you cleave either at room temperature or at low temperatures, certainly it is much better to do it at room temperature because oxygen can relaxes and rearranges itself better. But and that's something that we found and the group of Oyst and Fischer found as well. You rip the crystal, I mean, you cleave it, you certainly change the oxygen stoichiometry. And as much as it tries to rearrange, there is slight difference, I believe, between this layer and the next one. Why this is important? Because if you look at the structure, these are the two bismuth oxygen layers. By the way, if you didn't know, then the distance between the two adjacent bismuth oxygen layers is square root of 2 larger than any other vertical distance. It's not exactly a van der Waals. But it's a very weak bond. That's why it cleaves here so easily. So, but the bismuth oxygen layer is the charge reservoir for the copper oxygen layers. So this one gives the charge to this copper oxygen layer, where this one gives the charge to this copper oxygen layer. That's the two adjacent copper oxygen layers. If you cleave, then you altered the charge reservoir for the first copper oxygen layer. This is important for STM measurements, and this is important for photoemission measurements. For example, whether one can or cannot see bilayer splitting, because the two copper oxygen layers don't have exactly the same doping is a question. And there are other questions. This is also important if you try to think which is the best bismuth oxide sample to use? Well, it turned that the best one will be slightly underdoped, because for slightly underdoped, you'll have the longest coherence length along the superstructure. Namely, there are enough missing oxygens that the superstructure can align, and the system is, in a way, the most ordered, although there are missing oxygens. So these are remarks. Yes?
What's the meaning of the oscillatory dark lines?
Okay, that's okay, missing density of states interpreted as missing atoms in topography.
They look very regular.
Yeah. This is a sample which is slightly underdoped, and it's one of the best we could get in terms of long coherence lengths along the superstructure. You go overdoped, I don't have it's in a different talk. I didn't plan to talk so much about it. But you can see that in overdoped, you start to fill in, and the superstructure starts to be irregular. Similarly, in underdoped, you start to see much more irregularities.
So I guess what Don may be asking is this sinusoidal wave that you
have. Oh, here?
Yes.
Oh, it's not exactly. I mean, it's random. I mean, it's not. You look at the longer. Oh, you mean, I see, you're talking about this?
Yes.
No. I think it's simply going up and down in atoms. It's going up and down in atoms. It's not a sine wave. Okay, what about the spectrum? Well, if you look on the surface, you find spectra of various types of spectra. By now we know that this is a D-wave superconductor, and indeed in most of the area you find a spectrum that looks like this. You can fit it quite nicely with a broadened D-wave spectrum. In this particular case, the gap is going to be around 40 millivolts with a broadening of around 2 millivolts. That's not bad.
Sorry, to which site does it correspond? For which site is it?
That's not site. This is not site specific.
When of a larger ring?
Just looking at, I'll actually come to this point. In fact, that's the first part of the talk, is talking about what do you find where. So I'll come to it in a minute. I just want to mention that in these samples, namely around optimally doping, be slightly underdoped to slightly overdoped, you find a gap, the smallest gap that you find in regions that I will call, from now on, the good superconducting regions, which is about 30 millivolts. And this is a value that is found by also by the group of Seamus Davis, by the group of Oystein Fisher, and in fact by any other group that does this. Well, this all looks fine. However, when you try to ask yourself, is this really a good superconductor? I mean, you probe the gap, and that's actually what we also did in the early days in 88 when we looked at this system. At that time in 88, we only rarely found regions that have a gap. We published it. People said it's really not a good superconductor. You don't know what to find. Nowadays, samples are better. We do find more of this, but we cannot really find a sample that every point that you probe, you find a good superconducting gap. And this is not only our problem, this is everywhere. So from time to time, you'll see publications about long microns length of line scans that show nice gap. However, if you look carefully, you'll see that these are line scans. These are not two-dimensional maps. That's because I can find a line scan here, for example, in this direction, that will have good superconducting gap. But in general, if I look at a map, I'll find that there are regions that are not good superconductors.
Are these regions worse if they cleave at 4 Kelvin than if
you do? Yes. Yeah. From experience, especially of the group of Oystein Fisher, then the fraction of the bad regions is higher if you cleave at low temperatures.
Okay.
I mean, it's almost by a factor of two. However, you cannot get rid of them even if you anneal, even if you cleave at room temperature, let it anneal, even try to oxygenate, it doesn't help. You always have some.
So Fisher's reports have more to do with picking a line scan through there somehow.
Right.
Rather than it being.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ask Christoph Renner, he will tell you that, yeah, they. I mean, the answer will be they can find line scans, which are very long, of good superconducting gap. But, and I can also. But the question is, if you look at the surface, I mean, what do you find? And the answer is, you find that there are regions of inhomogeneity. So here, red means large gap, and blue means good gap, where the quality of the gap is measured by the coherence peaks. Okay, yeah.
I mean, there was some interesting on the fact that one is tunneling into the viscous oxygen.
Right.
And there is the copper oxygen layer.
Right.
So what is the, I mean, is it just, one can just read off the copper oxygen density?
Well, I don't think anybody knows. I mean, there were some attempts to calculate the matrix elements as you go from the bismuth oxygen layer down to the copper oxygen layer. I think the latest one is by Alias Dani et al. In a recent paper when they claim to tunnel directly to the copper oxygen layer in some cleaved samples, and they compared it with what one finds if you tunnel to the bismuth oxygen layer. But in general, I don't think people know, and I think that the answer is that we see the gap, so therefore these tunneling matrix elements are probably not anomalous or doing anything bad, so we just go through and that's it.
All right.
Yeah.
This color plot is a gap size distribution or gap width distribution, or is it
It's a gap size. The way we did it is by fitting to this formula. Okay. So and of course in the good regions we are going to have good fit with very small broadening feature. But if you don't have coherence peaks, you'll start to have a bad fit. It's approximately the size, I mean this size, okay? Yeah. However, in the regions of bad superconductor, the coherence peak disappears, so it's just the size of the two banks. That's what comes out from trying to enforce such a fit on whatever gap you find. So as I said, this is topography, that's the size of the gap, and what you see is that there are regions that have bad gap. Most of the regions have a good gap, slightly enlarged. The dark blue will be those 30 millivolts I told you. That's the smallest gap that one finds. But in general, this will be the 40 millivolts, these regions. That's the most of the area. And they look good, as I showed you before. However, there are regions roughly of 30 to 40 angstroms in size of bad. And I'll show you in a minute what is bad. What I want to emphasize is that there is no obvious correlation between the topography, and here you see the superstructure, and the occurrence of these regions. Here is, for example, one would think, oh, look, that's kind of a region of depressed density of states on the superstructure. Probably it's going to be a bad superconducting gap. Well, that's one of the best. And here, a region that doesn't seem to have anything, it has bad superconducting gap. Here, I mean, if you compare these two, here is one that shows some depressed topography, and indeed there is. So we cannot find any correlation between them. If you take a line scan, you see that you go from good gap. And that's the red are the bad gap, and you see that there are no coherence peaks, and this the gap simply widens. But if you look here, and I'll show it in a minute, I'll emphasize it. There is not much difference at low energies, and I'll show you in a minute. Just want to mention that these inhomogeneities in much more disorder and the underdoped samples. Were first found by Crane et al. These are on cleaved films. As you can see, again, there are regions of, I mean, they had very little because this is underdope. But it goes all the way from a decent superconductor to bad, there is opening of a gap. But if you look inside, the variations are not that much at the bottom of the gap.
Opening up more.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to be much larger than that.
Yeah, but these are really very underdoped samples, and I'm not going to talk about these kind of samples and what happened if you go there. If you look at such a region, if you, for example, do a 3D map, 3D picture, what you see is that the size of the gap increases. It's not very abrupt, okay? There are some variation as it increases, and the size is about 30 angstroms, 40 angstroms, okay, of these regions. Here I emphasize that what I mentioned. The gap changes, okay, and this is actually variation from going from the deep blue, that's kind of the best. You see the very sharp coherence peaks, nice gap, going to the edges as the gap widens, the coherence peaks go down, but if you look here, you don't see much difference. I have the same problem as always. It's okay. Sorry, I've been having this problem all the time. There is a map here. Sorry.
That's the bad data over there, is it?
No, actually, this is the gap, and that's just the bottom part that shows basically that there are no variations. I have this problem since I'm shifted to OS 10. I'll bring this. I hope that's the only one that is missing. The two extreme gaps are therefore going from a nice gap, for example here, to an increased gap, usually associated with a kink, roughly at the middle of if this is the gap, then roughly at the middle of the gap. There's a kink before it opens up, such that at low voltages, the variations in the shape are very, very small. And again, just to show you, there is no correlation between the location. Both of these were taken on the superstructure. One is good, one is bad. No correlation to the... Similar results were reported by the group of Seamus Davis also. That's an underdoped, that's as grown, that's again grown by Hiroshi Aisaki. These samples that he grows are slightly overdoped. And I think that the color scheme is opposite to ours. So you see that there are less regions that are bad. Very similar data. So possible explanations for these inhomogeneities. Well, first is point defect due to impurities. Well, besides the fact that I showed that there is no correlation between defects, obvious defects, and the most dramatic ones are related to the superstructure, and the appearance of these, in fact, these two are related. I'm going to show you that there are other reasons to believe that these are not associated directly to point defects under that region. In other words, if I have a bad region, I look under. Do I see under that region a slight change in doping, or do I see under that region an obvious impurity? The answer is no. Okay. I showed you some of these results. I'm going to show you some more. And there are other effects that are more global that have to do with variations in the properties of the crystals or phase separation. Okay. In other words, we do believe that disorder has to do with these inhomogeneities. But it's, if you want it, just like in vortex physics. If vortex is pinned, the question is there a pinning site, is this vortex is pinned on a pinning site, or it's more of a collective pinning, that, that there is a region that the disorder created a region of pinned vortices. And we actually believe that it's more of the second. So point defects, we studied point defects for a long time. Yeah.
What if it were the layer below that you can't see? Is that possible? You have a copper oxygen layer.
Right.
Below it, I can't remember, but I don't think there's calcium.
There is bismuth oxygen.
Yes, I do know.
And
Okay.
So the thing that can happen in these layers is a change of atoms. Bismuth will go for calcium, for example. This can happen.
And what if that happens below where you can't see? Then could it be point defects?
Yeah, it can. But I think some of it can be answered by what I want to say now. Okay? Yeah.
We made a study of all families, all known structures of high temperature superconductors.
Yeah.
And the only trend you see in these stoichiometric structures,
yes,
is really has to do with small changes in the distance to apical oxygen and whether you're bisco or lanthanum and so on. So tiny things do change the Hopping integrals tremendously in the copper oxygen layer. So I would expect that in this case where you make pretty drastic changes or you expect some inhomogeneity just in the layer above, you can easily expect that the influence just on the next layer, the strontium oxygen layer, will have that kind of effect. No. So you don't have to have occurrences or drastic things.
No, I'm sure that these happen. As I said, disorder is everywhere, either because it's intrinsic to this high TC or even more so because you cleave. But the question is whether I can associate those regions, bad regions, to a particular point of disorder, or it's more of a global effect. I want to say a few more things about site disorder. This we studied before, either and the group of Seamus Davis studied it in the copper oxygen layer by using doped zinc and nickel doped crystals. But in general, what one finds is that if there is any local impurity, you do find zero bias anomaly. Whether it's weak or it is strong, you find those zero bias anomalies. These are all kind of anomalies. I'm going to skip it. That same thing was found by Davis' group. There are impurities. You always find zero bias anomaly. That's an impurity in the copper oxygen plane, zinc impurity, weak disorder. In the slightly underdoped, those that I call the best superstructure systems, we can scan huge areas where we find those inhomogeneities, not a single zero bias anomaly. Okay? So I think this, together with the finding disorder and not finding correlation to the inhomogeneities, convince us that it's not. Similar arguments that it's not due to underlying disorder. Of course, there are similar arguments that it's local variations in in doping. To try and study this, we decided to use a very strongly oxidant atom, titanium, by sprinkling a little bit of titanium on the surface and do the spectroscopy. Yeah.
Is it only the low energy scale of the IV characteristic which is modified by the inhomogeneity, or also
no,
high energy?
It's only the high energy that is modified. The low energy, if you just look at the low energy, the near zero bias, you will not know whether the gap is large or small.
No,
you will.
Okay. It depends what you mean by low and high. I mean, how about the normal state characteristics above the superconducting gap?
Well, the normal states are tricky because there are effects. I mean, those slopes that you see from time to time, those large conductances, they depend on the sample, independent of what whether there is going to be a gap or not.
So they don't correlate at all.
No,
with
we didn't find it, and I don't think other groups found it, any kind of correlation.
And why is that? Is that because this?
I don't know. So, yeah.
When you say global, can you associate any length scale to that?
I'll try in a minute.
So the only thing which is reproducible is the stuff up to, I don't know, 40 millielectron volt?
No.
15?
I mean, the bottom part, which is about a third of the gap, if you just concentrate there, you will not know that the sample has inhomogeneities.
Okay.
If you stop there with the IVs. If you go further, you'll see that there are regions of an enhanced gap with no coherence peaks, and there are regions with beautiful gap.
And that's reproducible always?
Yes. The fraction is not. The fraction depends on the sample and on the preparation, but the fact that it exists in all samples. So we sprinkled some titanium atoms on the surface and did some spectroscopy. Here is, for example, two titanium atoms. That's the gap size. This one has large gap. This one has good gap. These are the two, and they are adjacent to each other. Okay, no correlation. Here, I think the best picture I have is actually on bismuth 2201. That's the single layer one. Again, you see the superstructure, and here are three titanium atoms. In that case, by the way, you see much more in all the 2201 that we measured. You see much more the alignment of the gap size with the superstructure than in 2212. But again, here is titanium, but which you could associate actually with some defect. There is a depressed gap. These two titanium atoms, actually, the gap is very good. And here is before and after. Same area before and after you put the titanium. Same point before and after you put the titanium. And what you see is that here, I mean, that's the change, for example, in a region that nothing happened. The blue is before, the red is after. So actually, we as much as we did this experiment, we couldn't find any correlation. So the facts are that we find these kind of inhomogeneities between slightly underdoped to slightly overdoped. Slightly underdoped, and that's actually very interesting, because the slightly underdoped have a much better surface in terms of the superstructure. The fraction of the inhomogeneities there is between 15 and 20%. The slightly overdoped, you can see the superstructure is much more disordered. Still, the amount of inhomogeneities is less, as if it really has to do with the charge, not with the disorder. And as I said, we don't find zero bias anomalies. There is no obvious correlation with local disorder or with doping variations. The bad region looked very much, I should have mentioned it, but it was probably obvious, very much like the pseudo gap. To just go fast, let me tell you what we think. We think actually that these regions have to do with some phase separation due to disorder, and the gradual shape of the gap comes from proximity. So if you want to create a bad region, and then you soften the edges using a proximity effect. So in a way, again, you see the low bias is you cannot really tell if the gap is going to broaden or not. That's this part. So that's the low bias. Then comes the kink when you are at a very a bad, quote unquote, bad superconducting part, and that part actually fits much better to the pseudo gap than to the superconducting gap. So if you ask, well, when does this stop being a good superconductor? If you use the simple type of BCS, you get that it's roughly between a third. It happens at a third to a half of the gap size, which gives you a size of the order of 2 to 3 size, which is this 30 angstroms. So this may or may not be.
What is the red line?
Sorry?
I didn't follow. What is the red line?
That's the high energy part, the high bias part, and it looks more like a pseudo gap. The low bias part looks, I mean, if you simply looked at the low bias, you wouldn't know that it's not going to be a good superconductor.
What is the size of the region of bad superconductivity?
I said about 30 to 40 angstroms.
And the domain, okay.
And it's interesting. It's the same in our experiments, in Seamus Davis experiments, and I think Christopher Renner told me that in their experiments as well. It's kind of same size. So the conclusion of this part is that all BSCO samples that we measured, and I think any other group, Davis, Pan, Yazdani, Fisher, they all find these inhomogeneities, and we believe that they do not correspond to direct disorder under the inhomogeneity, but rather it's more of a collective effect, and we think that it has to do with face operation. So I did spend more time than I planned, but on that part. Let me go now to the second part and tell you about now ordered structures, okay, instead of those inhomogeneities. So to remind you, we take BSCO, here's the topography, we look at the gap, and we find that the gap is inhomogeneous.
Sorry.
Yes?
So is there a large difference between these various regions even in the normal state?
Nobody measured it in the normal state. It's very difficult to do these measurements. We managed to do measurements up to about 18 Kelvin. I think that Fisher's group managed to do some measurement, but not aerial measurement, more line scans, on 2201. I don't think that there is much data in the normal state to look for these. I mean, there are lots of interesting experiments to do there. I mean, you know, you want to look at a bed region, you want to put a magnetic field and see if a vortex pins in. You want to look at this region and go above TC and see if this region stays, because it was in the first place a pseudo gap, kind of pseudo gap region. There are lots of things to do if one could change temperature. We cannot put right now a magnetic field, so we could not do the obvious experiment of putting a field and see whether these regions. But of course, if you do that, again, you wanna do the field, you wanna do temperature. So, yeah.
What happens if you raise the temperature above TC and then lower it back to the...
You never come back to the same place. That's the problem. You know, we are looking here at, what, 150 angstrom squares? The linear coefficient of expansion is of the stage that holds it, even of the sample, of everything, is, you know, you move microns. So you go up in temperature, you come back, you never come back to the same point. So you can change temperatures at low temperatures, but you cannot change temperatures at, going really to 100K and come back and be sure that you are at the same place.
Can you look at low TC? I mean, one of those families.
Actually, we started. But again, in our case, since the base temperature right now is, unless we pump on the helium and then the experiment has to be short, our base temperature right now is 6 Kelvin. So it's not, there's not such, such a variety of low TC. But we started to look at some A15s. Okay, so we look now at these samples. Now, when you do topography, okay, I told you that what you do is you plot here if you want, the variations in the current for a fixed voltage. Okay, that's the indication, that's the topography. When you look at the gap inhomogeneities, you measure an IV, okay, and then you fit the full IV to some function, extract a gap size, and then plot locally, plot a map of this gap size as a function of position in this two-dimensional map. But I want now to look at individual points on this IV and make maps of these individual points. In other words, this is the IV. I decide on a voltage and look at the IDV at that voltage in two dimensions. So you go from here. This is now the pixelated data. So you see the pixel size. And I think that from your distance, you see that there is some kind of a structure there. However, this may be a little bit difficult to see if there is any kind of structure, because you know, if you pick a voltage somewhere here, you already are in that region of changing of the gap, namely the inhomogeneities. They come in at a distance of about 30 angstroms, I told you, or you saw. So 30 angstroms, that's maybe of this size. So it may not be very easy to see. So what you do is you Fourier transform this picture. And that's the Fourier transform. And boom, you see those four peaks. Again, to orient you, this is the copper oxygen bond direction. This is the direction of the superstructure, OK? So in the picture I showed you before, the superstructure was vertical. So that's 45 degrees to the superstructure. And so if it's vertical, then in the Fourier space, it appears here. Okay. And that this is this one is at 15.
So where are the band gap regions in this plot? I mean, what is the, can one?
Well, okay, so bright will be high density of states, high DIDV. And black will be low DIDV, okay?
But that's
what?
But that part is not changing much with the size of the gap, large gap.
Yeah. If the gap changes, then you see it. I mean, it all depends where you measure. I told you, you pick a voltage. So you can pick a voltage here, 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 and here. For example, this one is at around 15 millivolts, so it's going to be somewhere here. Okay? Clearly, the lower the voltage, the smaller are going to be the variations. And we'll see where the variations are the largest. So this is if you now take more data and look at high energy. So there are things that lots of things here. So let me explain. I'll show more of this data. First is at the center. Okay, there is lots. This is at high energy. So you already passed the inhomogeneity energy. The inhomogeneity energy I told you is about a third to half of the gap. So it's about 15 to 30 millivolts. And we passed it. So there's lots of stuff here at small k, okay? I rotated it, so this is now the copper oxygen direction. These are the atomic positions. This one, more fainted here, okay? These are the atomic positions. And if you look at the Fourier transform, you look it back, you can see the atoms under. That's a ghost.
Is this real space or reciprocal?
No, this is Fourier space. That's the Fourier transform.
So these are the reciprocal items, not the
atoms. Yeah. Yeah, but these are related to the.
So this is 45-degree rotated again, or?
No. This is now.
Okay.
So that's the 1001 directions.
So the white square is the Brewing zone. Yes. Simple.
Yeah. So you see that's the corresponding to the atomic positions. There is superstructure. You'll see it better. But the superstructure. So the four points that I showed you before are therefore here. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's lots of stuff here, so it's very difficult to see them. Okay. But they are at this point. What I did here, I de-emphasized the color scheme. So, and in these circles are those four points. Okay. So that's the same center region here, but de-emphasized, so you can see. There's lots of stuff here, and so the superstructure, for example, is here. Is here, the superstructure with the atomic positions give you a ghost. These are the ghosts. And there are other things. So you'll think that this is it. Well, no, there are much better pictures, and there is much better data. You simply go to lower energies. So this is, for example, 11 millivolts. Okay. This is again the pixelated data. Okay. So I'm going to show you sometimes pixelated data and sometimes continuous, where basically I take the pixel and I interpolate between two adjacent pixels. But these are the four positions, and I circle this because, and I'll explain later the procedure. But what we do is you filter out these four regions, and that's what you get. Okay. So
from that original picture.
Okay. Yeah. So no, but that's no. It's this. It's the same area. But I explained, if you take the current variations at high voltage, that's topography. This is it. There you see the superstructure. Okay. If you look at the gap size and you make a map, that's the inhomogeneities. Okay.
Okay, but then same place, same scale.
Same place, same scale, 160 by 160 angstroms. If you now take the IV at 11 millivolts, that's somewhere here. You Fourier transform it, this is what you get. That's the superstructure here, okay? The inhomogeneities, they fill in here, the small k, and you see these four. Higher voltage, here I'm using the continuous color scheme, but again, the four peaks, and again, this is the couple. I apologize for the rotation, 45 degrees. My earlier ones were always in the direction of, making this a square instead of. So, but I will always have some orientation here. So you see, that's the superstructure. This is the couple ocean direction, and that's the Fourier transform. Okay. Again, the two superstructure peaks. There are some other peaks, and I will come to these peaks. But four peaks at the four positions of corresponding to exactly four period of four lattice constants. Okay, that's the calculation of autocorrelation. Again, a color scheme, and from a given point, you see the periodicity. Okay, there is no filtering, no nothing. This is a pixelated data. I take a point on that in real space, of that periodicity, and I look how much it persists, and it's about 7 periods, which is about 100 angstroms. Okay. You can do line scans to try and compare it to neutron. And what you find is you do a line scan again along this 1-0 direction, for example, or 0-1. And what you find is that this is the 4 period. And what you see is that, and again, the color scheme is for the energy. So at low energies, and you see it persists all the way to high energies. It is true that you have other peaks around that are coming in, but there is always a peak at a quarter, okay? That's one direction, and then the other direction is here. Now, there is an adjacent peak coming in, which makes this one here fainted or weaker. But this one here is always there, and I'll show you how one reveals this. Again, looking at a two-dimensional map as a function of energy, going from zero energy to 35 millivolts. I kept the contrast the same, and that's why at high energies you see these as fainted pixels, but you can look at the picture, they are there. And what you see is the important thing is that there are peaks at the four quarter distance positions all the way to zero energy. Now they appear the best at around 10 millivolts to, I don't know, 10 to 20 millivolts. You look at the energy dependence, you simply pick the intensity and you plot it as a function of energy, and that's what you get. There is intensity at zero energy, and then it peaks at around 20 or 15 to 20 millivolts, depending on the sample. Then it goes down. It changes sign at around the gap size. But there is intensity. Now, I want to emphasize that this is a Fourier analysis where I plot here not the amplitude of the power spectrum, but rather the real part. And I show you here the imaginary part. And this is very important. This is something that people who are doing Fourier transform of these pictures don't pay attention to. And I'll show you in a minute.
You're just looking at the one quarter point, is that?
Yes, yes. The intensity of the one quarter point. Why it is important to look at the imaginary part? I mean, to look at the full power spectrum and not just to look at the real and imaginary part and not just at the power spectrum. Because you take the IDV in two-dimensional space, and now you want to Fourier transform it. Now, this is not an infinite system. It is a finite system, which means that to do a Fourier transform is not simply clicking FFT on your MATLAB. It is choosing an origin and then Fourier transforming it, getting at each point in space a real and imaginary part. Okay? Now, when you do the Fourier transform, and here that's the density of states, and I emphasize here that it's for a sample of size L, and this L is actually very important. When you do it, then there is going to be an arbitrary phase that has to do for each k with the k and the origin that you chose, okay, which will come up front of the Fourier transform. Now, this is very important because, first of all, this is arbitrary. And second, the wave vector that you chose for features that are dispersive, this is going to have a phase that changes with the energy. It's not going to be fixed. This phase is going to be fixed only if the features that you look at are independent of energy. And this is very important. The question is, can you find a feature that the Fourier transform is in the Fourier transform is independent of the energy? And what you see here is that we've, I mean, this particular peaks at the quarter distance, namely four period, there are phase variations. These are the error bars, by the way. And clearly, this is within zero compared to the real part.
Just one sample you did DFFT on, right? I mean, just one picture, which you showed us before.
We did many samples. Yeah. We did many samples. Why?
Is this an average FFT, or is this just the FFT?
No, this is for one sample, but we did it on many samples.
Right.
And they all show the same.
Okay.
Now we measured. By now we measured on many samples, and we measured on samples with different tips, and at different temperatures. They all show the same thing. So how can you overcome this problem of this random phase? Well, again, you can do what people in Newton scattering do. You simply integrate up to the energy. So instead of plotting the Fourier transform, instead of plotting like here for that particular energy, okay, where you have lots of stuff around, what you want to do is you want to integrate up to this energy. Now, what should happen then is all the things that are that produce random phase or phase that changes with energy should average out, and the things that don't should come out. That's what happened, and I think that it's clear that this picture, which is the integrated up to 22 millivolts, is much cleaner than this one, with the four peaks at the four corners are very, very strong.
What's the possibility of picking out the stationary phase? Which might be the same thing, but stationary phase of something dispersing.
Fixed
stripes that give you something that's spacing but not highly energy dependent. I agree that's the type of thing you might look at, but it's also possible in these dispersion relations for the quasi particles that there are stationary points in them, which when you integrate will be amplified.
Well, if there are coincidences, there's nothing I can do about that. But
it may be well correlated though with the D wave aspect.
Well, the problem is that you have to remember, and I'll come to that and to the Wang Li paper, etc., in a minute. You have to remember that this is not a single impurity calculation. I mean, our sample has many impurities everywhere, and what we see is really an effect of many impurities that are in that picture. So you may hit one right, but you will not hit them all right. So I really don't believe in chances. So if you integrate, that's again pixelated data of the integrated density of states up to an energy, and these are the energies. And what you see is that these peaks are very strong. Although again, you cannot avoid the inhomogeneities. Maybe a better way to see it is to do a line scan. Okay, so that's the line scan of the DIDV, and that's the line scan of the integrated data. So as I emphasized before, this is the quarter. Okay, there's always a peak here, although at high energies, this peak is weak compared to another peak that emerges near it. But if you look at the integrated, all the way to the highest energy, I mean, there is no doubt that there is peak there that becomes stronger and stronger, which means that the integration adds this up, okay? Unlike all these, I mean, in this region, that it becomes, I mean, especially in the intermediate energy, it becomes weaker. So I think that there is no doubt that there are peaks there. So again, that's the raw data, and if you use that filter, and that's the way we do the filter, we simply, for the particular period, we multiply by a Gaussian filter, and that's the size of the Gaussian. It has about 36 points around that. And you cannot really pick a single point. A single point you can pick for any type of data. I mean, you do white noise, and you'll pick these four points. You'll get it. Okay? There are tests that show that indeed there is an underlying structure there. I mean, first of all, you can see the defects here. Okay? If you look at the defects, you want to see that these defects do not change with the size of the filter. Okay? You want to have the filter wide enough that it captures the defects. Because if you take it exactly at the 2 pi over 4, then, because as you can see, there are defects in this two-dimensional structure, then locally you may change the periodicity from 4 to 5, and therefore the pixel will be slightly shifted. Okay, so to capture all this, you need to take a filter which is wide enough. You can change the size of the filter, and we did change the size of the filter, and we see that the location of the defects do not change. This will not happen with white noise. When you do it, I don't have it with me. I should have it in hard copy for anybody who wants to see. If you take white noise, you filter it, then you see that the defects that appear there in the white noise are scale. The distance between the defects scale with the size of the filter that you take. That's the best way to check it. Moreover, there is huge intensity here. That's not what will happen if you had white noise. If you had white noise, then the intensity here will be the average of the intensity, and the intensity here is many, many times larger than the average intensity. So all points that there are some fixed modulation in the local density of states that may be associated with stripes. It's starting to be late, so.
So we've seen there are also stripes in the satellite. Did you argue that the stripes are connected with the good or the bad regions, or you said nothing about that?
I said nothing about that. In fact, the stripes are everywhere, and they fill the sample. The inhomogeneities are here and there. I cannot, and I tried it, take the same area, take the stripes. With the stripe structure defects and put it on the inhomogeneities and try to make correlations. Sometimes you find something, sometimes you don't. But in general, there is no direct correlation. So again, I don't have, and Doug will tell you everything you need to know about stripes. We are talking about. Charge modulation, and in that particular case, we are talking about charge and spin modulation, but we are in the superconducting state, so we are actually looking at fluctuating stripes. And that's actually, and we are at zero field, so. Basically, we are. If there is some quantum critical point associated with these stripes, then we are in the disordered phase, but close to this quantum critical point where there are fluctuating stripes. And the question is, what do we see? Well, clearly, the stripes. Clearly, the stripes, as you could see, are two-dimensional. It's not obvious to see that they are one-dimensional. But again, that's what you expect if you are in the disordered phase. I mean, you expect that this will respect the symmetry of the underlying symmetry, which doesn't have any preference. You are not. In the stripe phase. Why do we see it? Well, the stripes get pinned due to disorder, due to the inhomogeneities. Maybe they all get pinned due to disorder together. We don't know yet. Well, Though in other high TC, these were found in Newton scattering. The period now, because you look at the spin, is double as the spin order antiferromagnetically. So these are the peaks at 2 pi over 8a, that's 8th period, which will correspond to the change in the spin direction. This is in lanthanum strontium copper oxide. There are recent indications, I cannot assess these experiments of the group of MOOC, that say that they see these kind of features even at high TC YBCO samples, namely YBCO samples with the TC in the 90s. There have been many theories. I just want to mention that one of the theoretical papers that was trying to simulate the energy dependence of the four-period peak is by Podolsky et al. And they have cooked some kind of a model that has to do with dimerization, namely that it's not a single line that has to do with the stripe ordering, and they calculated from it the energy dependence of the four period peaks, and it looks quite similar. I don't have more to say about the relevance of their theory. Now, when I talked about inhomogeneities, I showed you results from other groups, in particular the group of Seamus Davis. I'm showing you these two-dimensional patterns, and I'm showing you again results from that group. So their first paper actually was on finding this kind of modulation around vortices. They apply a magnetic field, they measure locally the IDV locally with a field, without a field, they subtract the two, they Fourier transform it, and what they find is peaks at the four corners just like we do. You look at real space, you find around vortices these periods.
What energy scale are they integrating over? Or,
yeah. Well, up to 12 millivolts. Okay. Their claim is that at the time, this was before we published our paper, when Seamus gave the talk at Stanford, that they see it at around 6-7 millivolts, and but when they integrate, they want to capture, there is a feature in the vortex state at around 6-7 millivolts, so they integrate to pass that feature, so they integrate up to about 12 millivolts. Okay, but whether they integrate or they just look at small energy windows, they see the same thing there. However, there have been a suggestion that this has nothing to do with charge density order, but rather with quasi-particle scattering. In other words, you scatter from one K to another, and there are two possibilities. Either you scatter in the zero in the zero pi direction, or you scatter around the nodes. And in fact, this was suggested first by Dang Hai Li, and indeed, Seamus' group reanalyzed data very similar to our data, very very similar, except that they have higher K-space resolution. Their microscope is much more stable than ours, so they can take data for longer time, so they can take more data, and if you take more data, you can have more larger areas and therefore better K resolution. And I want you to concentrate on this part. That's the part of the along the direction of the four periods. And the claim is that what they see is a feature that disperses, okay? And then they put this picture and they say, well, look, it fits great, it fits the band structure, because they look at the dispersion of this feature and then they put the band structure in that direction, and which is this band, and they say, well, great. So I have two remarks, because obviously, people usually tend to think that having better data means that they're right. First, I'm not sure that I would call it better data. There is a problem in having larger areas. I showed you that the coherence length of these regions is about 100 angstroms. 100 angstroms was also found as the region by Seamus Davis himself in the magnetic field case. Our samples are about 160 angstroms in size, up to 250. Their samples are 500 and 600 angstroms. Okay, that's how they get better K resolution, which means that they have many more coherence areas, which means that they'll average more those peaks. Okay, and I think that's exactly what happens. Well, we look now again in the zero pi direction at the momentum transfer of one quarter, which is supposed to be the charge density modulation. So you look at, here they plot minus 6 millivolts, 10 millivolts, 14, 18, etc. And the claim is that by fitting a single line shape here, that you have a peak that disperses, because the average line shape here disperses. Okay? I think that if you go and examine closely, what you will see is that, as I showed you in our data, and it's exactly the same here, there is always a shoulder here. Let me be more specific. I don't believe it. Oh. Here is, for example, I'm taking this one and putting it here, okay? I don't think that you need much to see that this is really enforcing a single peak here. There is a peak. If the data is so good, and indeed it is, look how many peaks there are in this peak, which is at a quarter. Look. It's put at a quarter, at 18 millivolts, okay? And then there is this other peak, which I showed you is there. And you can examine each one of these, and you'll see that it's just like in our data. You go to higher energies, there is stuff coming in at lower k's which take over, but there is always a peak at the 2 pi over 4.
What about the second high frequency picture?
Sorry?
What about the high frequency picture in the previous slope?
Here?
Yeah, uh-huh.
What?
Clearly dispersing.
Yeah, there is. I agree with you. Yeah, there is clearly here, but there is also here. You have to be? My suggestion, of course, to them is integrate. Yeah.
I think you're definitely right. If you integrate, I think you can emphasize the strengths. What's happened, I think, is typical of the way things are published now. There's further data by Davis, but of course, unless he sends it directly to you, you don't get it till maybe you get it.
No.
We don't get it.
I'm not allowed to get it.
All I'm saying is that LT23, which I just came back from yesterday, they showed what the next generation data. And what they're showing now is you showed the stationary points, there were a couple of Q vectors.
Right.
They pick up 8 vectors and try and do it. To show the interference. And basically, I think, Aaron, when you see that, you'll agree that they're seeing quasi-particle interference.
Oh.
But I believe...
We see it as well.
I know. And I believe that when the dust clears, one's going to say there's stripe data, as you're showing this, and there's quasi-particle interference.
Absolutely.
As they push.
Absolutely.
The two are in there together, which I realize...
Absolutely.
...what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. And in our first paper, we try to emphasize the fact that there is a wave vector with fixed wave vector that does not disperse. We've seen all those other things, and you can see again, compare their data to our data, including that eight points that I heard about a few days ago. We have the same. The question is. And I think this is much more important than seeing things that Mike Cromie saw more than 10 years ago.
Some of us don't feel that way. Byers was a graduate student of mine with Glatte, and I talked about, I don't know, some years ago, the fact that you might be able to see quasi-particle interference of just this nature. So yeah. We're delighted to see this, and I think that you will see that
Okay. So if we are talking also about their data, and again, I was not allowed to see it. Somebody showed it to me a few days ago, and that those 8 points, we have to be clear for those who didn't see it. They are at very high wave vectors. They go beyond the 0.25, right? Yes. I've seen. No, but I can tell you and you can check. They are at large. We are concentrating now at the 2 pi over 4, and the question is whether there is or there is no.
Can I ask a question about
yes.
Basically, the question is, well, what is the size of the error bars on the graph? Meaning that suppose you take some other region and the Fourier analysis and
yes.
produce some similar data.
Yes.
What's the characteristic variation in the y direction, basically? What's the size of the error bar?
Well, I think I showed you. You don't need much. Just look at the. Yeah, I mean, for example, here. I mean, look at these circles. It's within these circles, and these circles produce this. The error bar is, in our case, one pixel away. This is going to be.
I'm not talking about the horizontal error bars, meaning the K resolution. I'm talking about the intensity resolution.
The intensity resolution? The intensity here in this point is 5 times the intensity in the background. There is no question.
So eventually, what's the error bar, the vertical error bar on that graph that you were showing, where you were claiming some satellite peak?
What satellite? I really don't understand what.
This, when you have a shoulder,
yeah.
The shoulder is inside error bars, or error bars are smaller.
Oh, again, you can see it. I mean, you can see it. I mean, at the very high, the 35 millivolts, which is the highest energy here, then it's going to be about 15% of the peak near it. But I mean, I don't think that's the point. I mean, the point is whether there is a distinguishable peak there or not, and you clarify it simply by the integration. Let me make point number two about it, and this is very important. And again, I suggest you look at that new paper. All this octet is at high wave vector, and this has to do with simple argument that can you or can't you and where will you see this quasi-particle scattering? Well, smartly this fit to the band structure stopped here at Q, which is 0.3. Okay. The thing is that we know the band structure from photo emission, and I'm talking now about three groups, Campuzano, Shen, and Johnson's group. They all agree on this point to within, I think Steve Kivelson found 2%. The three groups gave him the number. That's the number at zero energy, which is 0.39 something. Okay, so we know this point. Okay, so what you want to do is you want to plot it all the way to zero energy. So first of all, you see, and these are for they claim for different doping, and then you can put this line, which is for the same samples that we and Davis. Did for the slightly overdoped, the same samples that Aisaki made, that's what you get from the three groups, okay? This band, okay? So first of all, you see that there is departure of the band structure, the measured one by photo emission from this data at around 12, I don't know, 15, whatever you want it, millivolts. And this is actually not a surprise, Okay, you don't expect agreement. In fact, quasi-particle scattering should not give you peaks at this wave vector at zero energy. There is no way they can do it. It's very simple. Quasi-particle energy is here on the Fermi surface. Epsilon k is zero. Delta naught, I told you, is between 30 and 40 millivolts. Quasi-particle energy will therefore be delta naught over 2 times the D wave, cosine minus cosine, right? Okay, I'm scattering from k to k prime, and I want to scatter across the Fermi surface. So I want to go, say, from, I don't know, minus a quarter to plus a quarter, okay? So I do it. I go from 1k, which is, let's say, a quarter, with whatever ky is, to the other side, which is minus a quarter, which whatever ky is, okay? That's what will produce me 2 pi over 4a naught, over 4a, correct? Is this clear? Okay, if I go from here to here, okay? Now, I want to do it such that Q is exact. I'm talking about comparison of quasi-particle scattering versus a fixed modulation in the density of states. So I want to go, and I want this Q to be 2 pi over 4a naught, right? So how do I do it? I go from equivalent points. I go, for example, from minus pi over 4a to plus pi over 4a with whatever ky is, okay? Ky will be determined by band structure. Is this clear? Okay. And this has to be true, and that's exactly, you know, you can find it in Nankai Lee's paper, anywhere you want. So all I need to do is I need to go to band structure and ask for kx, or k, I mean, there, it's equivalent, kx 0.25, what is going to be ky? Well, again, it turned that all three groups will agree that it's around 0.6, okay? So I know kx and I know ky for that particular wave vector, okay? So I can calculate what is the minimum energy of quasi-particles. Because if I have less of this energy, there is no way I will have peaks at this wave vector. And I calculate it, and that's really the best estimate is for example, I took for delta naught the smallest gap that we measure, or Seamus measure, or Oystein-Fisher measures. Typically the gap is going to be 20 millivolts, okay? So I get 15 millivolts. So there is no way I can get peaks below 15 millivolts, unless the origin of these peaks are not from quasi-particle scattering, but rather from something stationary. This is the calculation of Danghai Li. These circles is where you expect those peaks. And again, look at low energies. There's nothing. Why? Because he used the exact same calculation and found that at low energies, you will not see. There is a little bit of density of states appearing at around 12 millivolts, okay? But there is no way, either at negative or positive voltage, that you will get at zero energies, certainly, or 3 or 6, that you will get peaks there. Now, I told you about the integration, okay? Just to show you, if you take low energies below that energy of around 15 millivolts, you integrate, there is no difference between the two. Okay? So there is difference at high energies where there is lots of stuff appearing which do disperse. But if you integrate at low energies, I think you can look at these two. One, that's the non-integrated, and that's the integrated, and the differences are very, very, very small. Mostly here due to inhomogeneities. Of course, inhomogeneities don't contribute much at 10 millivolts. And the four peaks are at the right positions for period. Again, here is another picture now of 250 angstroms. different sample than the previous one, shows the exact same type of data. The question is, of course, because you see with your eye, you see some directionality, whether there is some pneumatic order. So what we did is we took on that previous one, the 250, we took sub areas and looked at the Fourier transform of the sub areas. And then, of course, then the Fourier transform becomes very crude because you don't have many pixels. And then you plot, you see that there are four peaks, and you look at the strengths of the two directions in Fourier space. Okay? And you choose one. When it's strong, it's red, and when it's weak, it's blue. And what you see is that for the two peaks, when one is strong, the other one is weak. So there is some anisotropy in this two-dimensional structure. So I way over time, sorry. But the conclusions are that there are inhomogeneities. We don't believe that these inhomogeneities are associated directly with point impurities. And we do believe we see pin fluctuating strikes that coexist with superconductivity in BISCO, which had TC above 85K. And we started to touch on this question, and we suggest it as a possibility. So thank you very much.